Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with conflicting reports on who used chemical weapons in Syria and speak with veteran foreign correspondent Rhys Ehrlich, the author of Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence and Empire. We'll discuss efforts to get irrefutable proof of the use of chemical weapons by the independent UN International Commission of Inquiry that has been repeatedly denied entry into Syria by the Assad regime. Then we'll look into the regional turmoil following Israeli strikes on Syria that have escalated the proxy war between Iran and Israel. Aram Nagizian, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and author of Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects for War, joins us to discuss growing pressure on the U.S. to intervene and why neighboring Turkey is increasingly reluctant to get involved in a war that they mistakenly calculated would have ended some time ago. Then finally, we will examine whether an unlikely government agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, will stem the tide of unregulated money flowing into our elections following the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School specializing in election law, campaign finance, and ethics, joins us to discuss her article at the Sacramento Bee, "Will the SEC Save Us from Citizens United?" And joining us now is Rhys Ehrlich, a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iran, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rhys Ehrlich.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And what do you make of these conflicting reports, obviously initial reports of the use of chemical weapons, in particular sarin, originally attributed to the regime, and then Carla Del Ponte, UN former war crimes prosecutor and member of the commission, told a Swiss public radio that the rebels may have used chemical weapons, and now the commission itself, the International Commission on Inquiry, the UN Commission, have refuted what she said. So what do you make of it all?
Well, it shows you how highly politicized the issue is that a lot is riding on whether you think there was chemical weapons or not and who used them. And there's a growing hubbub in Washington to engage in some kind of military attack on Syria, and the chemical weapons would offer the perfect excuse. I think let's go back over what some of the claims are. The Israeli government and the U.S. government, CIA, have said that they are confident that there was sarin gas used in Syria, and it was by the Assad regime. They've not offered any actual proof of it. In fact, some of the details that have leaked out look pretty suspicious. For example, the Israeli general who made the statement said that they had video of people foaming at the mouth. Well, foaming at the mouth is not one of the characteristics of sarin gas. And a Global Post article recently, just yesterday, discovered that at least one of the incidents where the sarin gas was supposedly used, the medics, when they checked the blood samples, this was in Turkey, found no traces of sarin gas, and they didn't exhibit the symptoms of sarin gas. So there's a lot, as we remember from the run-up to the Iraq War, there was a lot of fudging and outright manipulation of data to get people very, very scared about Saddam Hussein, and I think we're seeing the same process going on in the U.S. now about Syria.
But sarin actually is not a gas. It's a chemical. If it hits
the
skin,
it become a vapor.
Vapor, but the actual contact with your skin is almost instant death.
Right. Well, if it's in heavy enough dosage, absolutely.
Yeah. So but one of the reasons why one is suspicious of the Syrian government is that their repeated denials of repeated attempts on the part of the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Syrian Arab Republic, as its official title is. They've been trying to get in and offer irrefutable proof one way or the other, and the Assad government continually blocks them.
Yeah. As your listeners know, and as you know from previous interviews we've done, I'm no fan of the Assad government, and I'm highly critical of his dictatorship. But I think what they're sitting in Damascus, they're worried that if they give an open-ended permission for a UN inspectors to come in, they could see a rerun of what happened in Iraq, where you know, the U.S. is now known to have planted homing devices and done all kinds of illegal activities that later aided in the U.S. war effort against Iraq. And I think the Syrian government wants to limit it. And it could be that they've got something else they want to hide that they're afraid the inspectors might come across that don't have anything to do with the chemical weapons.
But there's never been much logic in the first place for the regime to use chemical weapons unless they were sort of testing the resolve or something, and that's hard to believe.
Yeah, it's hard. It's usually, you know, I use a pretty good rule of thumb in my reporting. If it doesn't make sense politically, then it doesn't make sense, and it makes absolutely no sense for Assad right now to use chemical weapons. In fact, the opposite might be true of the rebels, or a faction of the rebels, becoming so desperate they want to gin up a U.S. attack. Just in the last few days, there have been real setbacks for the rebels in Damascus and Homs and a number of other cities. Chemical weapons, Assad is not stupid. I've interviewed him twice. He's a very shrewd character, evil, but very shrewd. And he knows that if he uses chemical weapons, it's the excuse the West has been waiting for to come in and flatten his regime and kill him. So it makes no sense politically for him to do that. And you don't test out using chemical weapons to see if the West goes for it. And then if they don't anything, you do it, then you use more chemical weapons. I mean, that's just absurd. That's the kind of logic that comes out of Washington, but it's unrelated to the real world.
Well, it also, though, doesn't make a lot of sense. At least there's not much probability that the rebels would have sarin. They're a non-state actor, and they're in various factions, and it would be hard to figure out how they get hold of it.
I agree, and that's why, you know, the Assad government's claims that the rebels were using chemical agents don't make a lot of sense either. It's possible that they're trying to mimic the use of sarin or some by using some other chemicals. It's possible that people were reacting to tear gas. You know, a heavy dose of tear gas in a closed area can cause a lot of very bad symptoms and even death. So it's simply unclear. I would be very interested in what the Carla Del Ponte's group has come up with that led her to make her statement.
And again, I'm speaking with Rhys Ehrlich, a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy, and The Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. Now, clearly, there's a possibility here that, well, first of all, just in terms of personalities, Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, I think has obviously wanted his friend to become the president, Mitt Romney, and doesn't much like Obama. And I think probably, at least I've been hearing reports that they sort of have kind of contempt for him. There was a very macho statement from an Israeli former head of Israeli military intelligence, a general, who said to Israel radio over the weekend that, you know, when we have a red line with Iran, we really mean it. But the Americans are kind of, you know, squishy about their red lines, referring to the White House being kind of gutless. So, I mean, how much is this just a sort of macho on the part of the Israelis, or are they really trying to push the administration into action?
Oh, I think they're trying to provoke the U.S. I mean, on what grounds does Israel have to carry out bombing raids inside Syria, a sovereign country? They claim they're stopping missiles from being shipped to Hezbollah, but they make that claim about everything. There was apparently 100 Revolutionary Guard soldiers killed in Damascus at a military headquarters. What does that have to do with missiles to Hezbollah? What's really going on is that Israel would like to see the U.S. and probably Britain and France set up a military attack on Syria, which would be to Israel's advantage, although I think, frankly, it's going to cause more problems for Israel in the long run. But I guess apparently their short-term thinking is get rid of Assad, put in some kind of pliant government in Syria, and that Israel will be better off. But they're playing with fire. They did that in Lebanon, and the result was Hezbollah. You know, so it's not in Israel's interest to provoke yet another conflict in the region.
Well, but it also not in Israel's interest to turn this conflict into an Arab-Israeli conflict. That's the very thing that Assad wants, and he's been wanting ever long, for all along. In fact, the rebels have always accused Assad of being too soft on the Israelis.
Yes. Well, that is the dirty little secret about the uprising in Syria, is that nobody supports Israel in Syria. Everybody in Syria wants the Golan back, and where it was seized in 1967 by Israel. And it's a matter of tactically how hard do they want to fight against Israel at this time, etc. Yeah, I think unfortunately, I think the Israel has made an accurate calculation that Assad is so weak that he even a two-day assault on the Damascus airport, on one of his military headquarters, etc., that he's too weak to be able to respond. He simply politically and militarily now, he can't fire missiles back at Israel. I doubt that Hezbollah is going to do that, although that's a possibility. And so I think the Israelis are calculating that that Assad is so weak, he can't turn it into an Israel versus Arab war.
But there were so many secondary explosions in these attacks on the airport in Damascus and on the facilities around Mount Kaisun, where the Revolutionary Guards have their headquarters. And, of course, the 4th Division is run by Maher Assad, the brutal brother of Bashar al-Assad. So what explains the enormous secondary explosions?
Well, I think they hit military stores. You know, I'm sure they hit munitions. Right. That doesn't mean they were missiles on their way to Hezbollah. That's the excuse that Israel has used. It claimed had bombed a nuclear weapons site or one that was about to be developed a few years ago. I mean, they come up with a reason to bomb and then come up with some excuse to justify it. I'm sure they hit some kind in the nuclear strike or so-called nuclear strike. They hit a military target. It just wasn't a nuclear one. And in this case, I think they hit military targets that may or may not have had anything to do with Hezbollah.
So what is John McCain up to then, going on Fox News on Sunday and basically deriding the administration, saying, you know, the administration won't have a no-fly zone over Syria, but the Israelis can fly in there and bomb at will. So, you know, what's their problem?
Well, that's because that's because Israel is our ally, so anything they do is okay. I guess these guys don't bother to read the news about what's happening in Libya. You know, I mean, this is the scenario. You go in, you have a no-fly zone. It still took them 7 months to get rid of Gaddafi. And while there's an elected parliament and a prime minister, the real power in Libya is the militias. And they killed the U.S. ambassador. They blew up the French embassy. Is that what they want to see happen in Syria as well? So you have yet one more destabilized Middle Eastern country with the danger of right-wing extremists using Islam as their excuse. That's what McCain is basically advocating.
Well, he's also, I think, downplaying the complicated nature of a no-fly zone. It's one thing to lob some standoff missiles from Lebanese airspace into Syria. It's another thing to have a round-the-clock air umbrella over a country. That's a huge undertaking.
And what does it do to the people of Syria? I mean, that apparently doesn't count. The numbers of Syrian civilians who will be killed in this process. They're collateral damage, I guess.
Well, but, you know, the Syrian regime is fairly unconcerned about how many civilians they killed. They're lobbing bombing and lobbing Scud missiles into civilian areas.
Right, and they're wrong as well. And the fact that they're doing it doesn't justify the U.S. doing it too.
So what's your sense then of this thing, from what I can tell? And I talked to a Syrian yesterday who said that the Assads have issued Plan B, which is for the Alawites to move to their ancestral homes in the mountains on the Mediterranean coast, and they're digging in there, and that's what the ethnic cleansing of those Sunni villages is about. Is that what you think is happening?
Well, I know that's an idea that's being tossed around a lot among intelligence and media folks. I don't think it's real. First of all, the number of people, you know, the Alawites are somewhere around 10% of the population in Syria. In order for something like that to succeed, they would need a way to get their weapons resupplied and their food supplies and their economy to function. And there's no major power willing to do that. You can't survive on your own, surrounded by hostile powers, including Israel and presumably the new rebel government in Syria and so on. So I, whether or not Assad is planning for that, which I've not seen any convincing evidence of, but let's even say he is, there's no way that that's going to survive. Because there's not enough, there's no outside power. Iran can't do it. Russia is not about to do it. And there's nobody else around.
Yeah, but it's better than being dead, isn't it?
Well, that may be his plan, but, you know, Gaddafi's plan was to hightail it into the desert, and look what happened to him.
Well, so is this to say then, Reese Ehrlich, that this, the agony will go on?
Well, I mean, I have stopped predicting what's going to happen in Syria. You know, when I was there, people told me it would be over in a matter of 3 months, and that was quite some time ago. I think the most dangerous thing that can happen is further foreign military intervention. It's going to escalate things beyond the horrors that are going on now and make it much worse. Eventually, the people of Syria will resolve this themselves.
Well, there's no indication that Obama wants to get involved, and I think he's reading the polls properly, isn't he? The American people are war-weary, and Iraq is a disaster, and it's going to looks like it's the civil war is going to resume there, and Afghanistan is a complete disaster, and those generals who advocated the surge ought to be tried for as war criminals. I mean, they absolutely achieved nothing and just killed a whole bunch of U.S. servicemen Indeed. And women.
Indeed. I think President Obama and the kind of, shall we say, what passes for doves these days in Washington want to see Assad overthrown, but they want to do it with a light U.S. footprint. So they're arming the rebels, but they're doing it through Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And Turkey. They want to see a new government that's pro-U.S., but they have not been able to come up with anybody that's reliable in that regard. The hawks in Washington, which includes some people within the administration, and, for example, John Kerry and others, they want to see a direct military intervention under the guise of a no-fly zone. So far, Obama, I think, has correctly resisted that. But he's still playing with fire by all these CIA activities that are going on today.
But the U.S. is in no way on the same page as Saudi Arabia. That's one of the incredible blindnesses in our foreign policy, that we somehow still think that the Saudis are our friends. When they created the Taliban, they've destabilized Pakistan. They're bringing al-Qaeda into Syria. I mean, they've turned Islam into at least not the religion itself, but their version of Islam is incredibly militant and xenophobic and austere. And I can't believe that we don't see that the writing on the wall. The Saudis are supporting the al-Qaeda types.
They are indeed, although officially they're supporting the moderate and nationalist forces. That's what they told me when I was in Saudi Arabia and what they're officially telling the U.S. No, I think the problem is the U.S. doesn't have a lot of options, and allowing Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey to arm the rebels is a way the U.S. claims it's not being directly involved, but then it gives freedom to those countries to arm the rebels that they like, who may or may not be in the same interest as the United States. And it is the pickle that a weakened empire faces. In the old days, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they would have just landed the troops and stayed there for as long as until the guerrilla war forced them out. Obama is trying to do the traditional kind of boots-on-the-ground U.S. Intervention, but it then weakens his ability to do other things.
So are we then to be thankful that George W. Bush hastened the end of the empire?
I'm I'm going to have to visit his museum, you know, his presidential library, to figure that one out. apparently there's interactive games about what decision would you have made. Yes, I think George Bush, not intentionally, of course, but did with particularly the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, has done more to damage the U.S. empire than any president in recent history.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Rees Erlich.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Rees Erlich, a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorist Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the region, talking about the regional implications of Israel's strike on Syria.